Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. I think I've probably been asked about 500 times over the last several years, you know, why are Republicans so reluctant to speak out against Donald Trump? When are we going to see the break among congressional Republicans against the Trump administration? I mean, even when you have the president who goes onto foreign soil and kisses up to dictators and takes cheap shots against his political opponents, it barely raises a squeak. And some of the most prominent Republicans seem to have gone off into witness protection programs. I don't always have the right answer for why more Republicans aren't willing to speak out against Donald Trump. But our guest today is somebody who probably has a pretty good idea and has paid a pretty steep price for doing so. Former South Carolina Governor and Congressman Mark Sanford joins us on the Bulwark Podcast. Thanks for stopping in today.
My pleasure.
Well, let's talk about it. We're watching Justin Amash stand up and call for the president's impeachment. It's probably not the start of something big, but it certainly highlights the fact that he is the only member of Congress who is saying these sorts of things. So I'll toss the ball to you before we get into more specific questions. How do you answer the question why more of your former colleagues were not willing to go down the path that you went down?
Well, everybody's going to walk their own walk politically. And, you know, if I was to talk to Lindsey Graham, who I started with in politics, 25 years ago, what he'd say is, shifting my position with regard to Trump allows me to stay relevant. I'm still in the game. And in contrast, I'm not. So part of it is a desire to just continue to be relevant in the political process, because when you're out, you're out. And then part of it is self-preservation. You know, the saying is, it's the pioneers that end up with arrows in the back. And so nobody wants to pioneer on any subject. It's not just Trump. It's a lot of other subjects out there that need addressing. And yet people play it safe. When an issue's hot, I mean, politicians are like bees on honey. I mean, you just can't get away from the mic or from the television camera. But until it's viewed as safe, people are naturally leery. And so you put those two things together in a forceful personality with Trump, and you got the formula that we have going right now.
Okay, so why did you make one decision and Lindsey Graham make another decision? We know what decision he's made. Why did you make the decision that you made, which ultimately cost you your seat in Congress?
Again, everybody's got their own walk. And so in my case, I was given a second chance in politics. I was given a second chance by the voters along the coast of South Carolina. That's a profoundly humbling personal experience to go through. And so part of it was, I was not unaware of the danger of what I was doing. My media folks were like, shut up. And my point was, look, I'm not looking for a fight, but I can't back away from one if one comes, based on the fact that folks at home have given me a second chance, and I owe it to them just to shoot it right down the middle. Not look for a fight, but not veer from one. I'll give you an example. I think that at the time I was asked by a reporter, I may have been the only former governor in the U.S. House of Representatives. Later, Charlie Crist came in, but some reporter comes up and says, with the next presidential election, do you think whoever it is ought to release their tax return? And I said, because ultimately it's really not about presidential returns. It's about down ballot returns. Because believe me, if at the presidential level they discontinue that tradition, and it's a tradition and nothing more than that, believe me, 50 gubernatorial nominees across the country, or 100 actually when you get Republican and Democrat nominees across the country, will no longer release theirs. And I didn't like releasing mine, but I did because it was a tradition. So anyway, I have my little spiel. Then along comes the nomination process. Trump gets the nomination. Same reporter comes back and puts the microphone in your face. And you're left with this sort of moral dilemma. Well, I know this is not exactly wise politics, because I know I've come to learn he takes the tax return issue quite personally. But I owe it to, again, to not only the folks I represent, but my four sons, just to say exactly what I said before, not to change based on the personality in office, but to stay true to certain principles or ideals that you happen to hold.
So what is your fundamental, what really caused you to break with Trump? What problem do you have with President Trump? Because you agree with him on a variety of issues.
Despite the fact that, you know, being viewed as a villain on that front, if you look at my voting record, it was a consistent conservative Republican voting record. And therefore, on most issues, it absolutely aligned. I think it was like 93% congruence in terms of voting record. I differed on some things in regard to offshore drilling because it's a local issue here on the coast of South Carolina, important to the folks that I represent, ultimately an issue of federalism. If every local mayor and town council comes up with a resolution, you're to be their courier in carrying that message to Washington. But anyway, I voted with the president overwhelming, more than 90% of the time. But what I disagreed with is, you know, in life, one of the things we teach our kids is that the ends do not justify the means. And I think that one of the traps that we've fallen into as Republicans is both accepting the short term and not looking at the long term. In other words, I think that the Trump phenomenon, and we saw it in this congressional district that I formerly represented, soccer moms are walking. They're like, wait a minute, this is not consistent with the lessons I want to be teaching my kids. I don't like the tone. I don't like the banality of some of what comes across. It's just too crude, too cutting, too caustic. I'm out. And that's not just in my former congressional district. It was in Carlos Cabela's district down in Miami. It was in the district out in Oklahoma. It was in Dave Brat's district up in Richmond, Virginia. Wherein people are saying enough is enough. And so I think it is, for me, a question of tone. And the ends don't justify the means. What we can't say as Republicans is, if we get a couple of good Supreme Court appointments, we get some dereg and we get a tax cut, we will look the other way on all else that goes on. Because we are, in fact, going over the cliff with regard to government spending, debt, deficit. We're going to have incredible consequences there. And to say that tone doesn't matter, it's impacting not just soccer moms, but it's impacting young millennials. I mean, so we may pick up some short-term wins, but the long-term, we may be in that much tougher a position going forward based on the permanent damage that I believe is being done to the Republican Party and the conservative movement based on the current occupant and the way he's scaring people away.
So how many of your former colleagues share your view but won't express it publicly, do you think?
I think more than meet the eye. Again, it's one of those things where people will say privately around a meal in Washington, that's just crazy. Anybody else in politics would be dead if they said X, Y, or Z. But, I mean, it was the president himself who said, I could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and my base would still be happy with me. Thus far, it's proven remarkably accurate. But, you know, I don't think it lasts forever. I think that times are good economically. When the economic times change, so too will the mood of the country with regard to its willingness to put up with some of what's going on. You know, our founding fathers gave us two interesting things. They gave us, one, a reason-based republic. And right now, politics are as tribal as I've ever seen it. Now, there's blame to go on both sides on that. But I know that, you know, I think it was Newton or Einstein. I can't remember who it was. But basically what they said, for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction, whoever it was that said that. And so some of the way in which Trump will just get in people's faces and be caustic, you know, whether it's with an ally across the Atlantic or whether it's somebody here in the United States, he's causing a reaction. I did a town hall meeting back maybe a year and a half ago in the time that the healthcare issue was hot. And these were big town hall meetings. I mean, a lot of my peers quit doing them because they got kind of cantankerous, well, real cantankerous. Group called Indivisible was teeing up a lot of opposition. And anyway, I continued to do them. And one of these big companies, maybe there were 1,000 people there, and one guy was just particularly obnoxious. And I didn't know him, but I knew of him. And so afterward, I went up to him. I said, "Look, I don't know you, but I know you by reputation. And whatever this was that was going on doesn't sound like the you that I've heard about." And his response was, "Look, let me pay you the deal. If the President of the United States can say anything to anybody at any time on any subject, why can't I?" And so what he's done is he's given people license to say some crazy stuff. It doesn't make it right what they're doing, but leadership matters. And you can look at that in a military sense, in a business sense, in an education sense. And people look to the top for cues in the way that they are to behave or to interact. And I think, again, it's awfully harmful. With a nation of laws and not men, and there's too much reliance on one man, one personality, in our system right now. But anyway, moving right along. I'm
Well, no,
sorry.
you're talking about the way in which the political culture has changed, and I want to talk about your last campaign a little bit. And because I had a brief conversation with one of your former colleagues who knows you quite well, and I'm not at liberty.
Sure.
I mean, I will tell you off the air, but I don't want to violate his confidence.
Yeah.
And he was describing how painful these final campaigns are, watching people change. Now, I'm in Wisconsin, and I watched a conservative movement that I think was principled, decent, watch them morph themselves, change their standards. And I've quoted Jonah Goldberg many times. It was a little bit like watching Invasion of the Body Snatchers. So talk to me a little bit about your experience, because the people in your district knew you very well. You had been the governor. They had given you a second chance. They'd elected you to Congress. You must have known some of these people for, 10, 20 years. And then go back to your district and find out that they were going to punish you because you were insufficiently loyal to Donald Trump, because you raised some of the issues that would not have been controversial. Standing up and talking about these kinds of issues, these values before, would never have been controversial in Republican circles. And suddenly it changed. Can you just describe what that was like?
Well, it's interesting. Just it's a sign of the times, which is I didn't change one iota. You look at my voting record, it's a remarkably conservative voting record. But those merit badges didn't matter in this particular period of time that we're in right now. What matters is allegiance to the president. And I think that's a dangerous spot to be. If you read Hayek's book, The Road to Serfdom, what he talks about is how, open political systems become more and more dysfunctional over time. So much so that a strong man comes along, says, "I'll take care of these problems for you." And it's obviously the story of Hitler's rise to power in pre-World War II Germany. Now, I want to be clear. I'm not likening Trump to Hitler. I want to be explicit in saying that. But what I am saying is the phenomenon we need to watch out for. So on the one hand, people are so profoundly frustrated with Washington and the way in which it's not working for themselves and those that they love that, if somebody can break the tea in China, Godspeed. They're like, "I'm ready. I'm sick of this." And so the guy may be a little bit out there in terms of some of what he says and does, but I'll put up with about anything if somebody can rein this beast in. So I think we all got to acknowledge that reality of where people are, and I get it. But what we also need to remember is we have a system that was carefully built around institutions and checks on power and checks on prerogative so that, yeah, it'd be frustrating. But relative to every other political system out there in the world, it's pure genius. And so what I experienced in my home election, and it was a narrow, it was, a couple hundred votes, and I would have been in a runoff, and I've been in two of those in my life, and I've won both of them. So it was a couple hundred votes. But still, what happened is people want to see stuff done. And they think that the way in which they'll get stuff done is by marching as a team. And I respect that. But where I think we're making a mistake is saying we have to be in groupthink on all fronts. For instance, I got into it with Mick Mulvaney back when he was head of OMB and I was on the budget committee. I was like, "This is a make-believe budget. You're going to create trillion plus dollar deficits going forward." I'm going to be ultimately right mathematically. He'll be right politically. And he was, you know, assuming growth rates that can never happen. So I think it's a healthy and a sign of strength in a relationship, whether with a spouse, a business coworker, or in the body politic. If you can say, look, I love you, but let's agree to disagree on this one. But here's the big part that's missing right now. You do it in a civil form. Civility is the glue that holds disparate perspectives and disparate groups of people together. We got to find a way to say, look, I totally disagree with you, and I'm going to fight you to the end of the day, but I don't vilify you as a human being. And we're losing that right now, and that's part of the glue that's held our democracy together and our republic together for 200 years.
And very consciously losing that. I mean, there's this really, you know, I think, very significant debate going on involving David French from National Review and one of his critics who basically is arguing, his critic is arguing that we can no longer afford things like civility and decency, that you know, that we are at war, and in the culture wars, we have to use every single weapon. So those things are being pushed aside. So let me ask you this, though, because when this question comes up, why no one in the Republican Party stands up to Donald Trump, and I think we've gone through the substance of it, that the answer is often, well, because they don't want to be Jeff Flake or Mark Sanford. So do you have any regrets that in some ways you have become the cautionary tale that by speaking out against Donald Trump, he and his supporters made an example of you? And if there are other congressmen who are not just an Amash, who might be, you know, sympathetic to what you're saying and would like to do the same sorts of things, that basically, you know, there you are hanging from the lamppost saying, don't go the way that Mark Sanford went. Do you have any regrets?
Zero, none. You know, I've been in a lot of elections over, again, roughly 25 years in involvement in politics, not 25 years in office, but involvement in politics. And it's funny, you know, that night my four sons were with me. And then we went after the election results and everybody left the gathering to a place called Cookout. It's just a local dive hamburger place. And we stayed up till 3 o'clock in the morning that night talking. And to a boy, they were all like, Dad, if you got to go, this is the way to go. This is exactly what you taught us about standing up for certain things you believe in. It's easy to stand up for things when there's no cost. It's a little bit more difficult when there is a cost, but that's when it's most important. And I think what we've got to ask ourselves as a civilization and as conservatives is, okay, is there a cost? Again, going back to means justifying the end, short-term versus long-term, is there a cost going forward to a tone that's broken in the way that we interact one to another in the body politic, and ultimately at a reflective level, across the 300 plus million people that make up America, you know, is there a cost to having the highest office holder in the land frequently tell things that aren't true? I mean, everybody hedges stuff and fudges stuff in the body politic. I get that. But he has been an outlier with regard to the degree to which he'll stretch it. And is there a cost to that? I would argue that there is, that truth ultimately is foundational to an open political system, because I can argue with a liberal Democrat, and he may see it. He may have a different version of the way he sees it. But if you don't have truth out there in the middle that you can objectively argue, you don't have an argument, and it becomes pure tribalism, which is what we're drifting toward. So I just think that there's some tremendous cost that we aren't accounting. I felt very comfortable with the cost of my election, because ultimately ideas we believe in are much bigger than any one of us as individual candidates who may be couriers of those ideas.
So what do you think about what Justin Amash is doing right now?
I think he's a brave guy. I called him and I said, look, I'm in your camp, and anything I can do to help, let me know. There's a danger to groupthink. I mean, think about the Bay of Pigs down in Cuba years ago. A bunch of right people in the room, but because they all just sort of agreed, disastrous results. And so the idea of different perspectives A is important. And so, okay, great. He has a different perspective than most of the conference. But he shouldn't be reprimanded for that. I mean, the idea of the Freedom Caucus, which is about freedom and the you know, most fundamental, the first one out there is freedom of speech. You get to have your version of what you think, and I get to have my version. Now let's argue it. Welcome to America. But the idea of saying, no, you can't say what you said. We condemn it. What a joke.
So you called Justin Amash because he's got to be feeling awfully lonely these days.
I know what lonely's like, and so believe me, I call friends when they're in lonely spots.
your story is also interesting. I'm always interested in the stories of redemption and your return to Congress. As you pointed out, you got something that is very rare in politics. You got a second chance. Had you been a very, very successful, very popular governor of the state. And you were involved in a scandal, but you were able to turn that around. And I guess, you know, this is one of the things about America is, of course, you know, people do have the second acts and everything. Looking back on that, what did you learn from that experience? Because most people, that would have been the end, and we never would have heard of you again. And you certainly would not have then later emerged as the conscience of the Republican Party in the House. So what happened to Mark Sanford in between the sort of the you know, riding high, the fall, and then the return?
Well, I'd just say two things to anybody who has an up and then a down in life. One, you gain perspective and you gain humility. Both are vital to becoming a better leader and a better human being. You know, for a lot of us, you know, doors just keep opening. It's not like some genius plan or anything, but doors just keep opening. Like, so you keep walking through them and you think, well, I guess this is normal. But even if it's not, but you don't know better. So you gain perspective on the way down and you gain a whole lot of humility. And that's invaluable in having empathy toward others in terms of entertaining other perspectives and saying, I know what I believe. I know I believe it. But let me have the humility to at least hear your perspective and see where I'm wrong or right. And so I think you gained those two things. I fell in love with somebody I shouldn't have, and I'll carry that to the grave. But I tell you, it's an amazingly, I go back to the same, humbling experience. So there wasn't any plan on my part. It was all God's grace and grace of the people that I represented down the coast of South Carolina gave me a second chance, and I was thankful for it.
So do you think that you would have taken the position you took vis-a-vis Trump, being willing to be the outlier, had you not gone through that earlier experience? Did you say it's humbling? And do you ever wonder whether
probably
or not...
Yeah, not, because what happens is when you're still on the way up, you know, you don't want to jeopardize, oh my goodness, I'm still on the way up and this could lead to that, and all these people talking in your ears and saying, hey, you know, play your cards right and whatever. You got all those whispers and yet when you've been to a dark place and you've already been dead, you don't fear death as much, and at least in a political sense, and so that's, it's freeing. It allows you to say, you know what, I've been out of politics before. Life went on just fine. It's a different chapter of life. What I care most about are a handful of friends. You go from having 40,000 people on your Christmas card list and wondering, now who exactly is my best friend in this list, to having, you know, to having, you can count on one or two hands the number of really close friends that are there with you in the dark days. And you're like, there's no confusion. Forget the 40,000 person Christmas card list. I'm sticking with these 10 and I'm focusing on them. And so it's just a very cleansing and clarifying process.
It is
allows you the
though,
freedom to take risks. Yeah.
Well, you were basically all out of bleeps to give. No, I mean, it did clarify things, yeah. And it did allow you to make take those sorts of risks. But you do certainly find out who your real friends are. I mean, that's a very clarifying experience. You realize that a lot of the people who've been around you, and I'm sure this is always a problem when you're the governor, or you're a senator, or you're a congressman. You have lots of people who are, you know, your quote unquote friends as long as you're in power, and you very quickly sort them out, don't you?
Very, very quickly. It's not saying they're bad people, but it just, you know, you're spent rocket fuel, and they move on, and you realize, okay, well, that was a chapter, but that chapter's gone.
So what's your chapter now? You just had a birthday this week, right?
I did.
Yeah.
I'm 59, which is a daunting thought, you know? Where did all the years go by? How did my boys grow up?
you're a young man. You could be at the state we're at now. You could be running for president 20 years from now.
Yeah, I don't like that. What's happening?
Yeah. So what is your next chapter? Do you think?
I don't know. You know, I've been teaching at the University of Chicago for the last couple of months, and that was a great experience. It's sort of a part of a self-imposed sabbatical. I gave myself till June. I got out of Congress in January just sort of to stop, simplify. I've been throwing a lot of stuff away that is accumulated in terms of political memorabilia and whatnot over the last 25 years, and getting organized for whatever it will be. And my prayer has been, God, open doors and closed doors and tell me what you want me to do. And right now he has not told me exactly what he wants me to do, and so I'm being still waiting and enjoying the start of summer here in Charleston.
So you're back in South Carolina. When's the last time you talked with Lindsey Graham?
It's been some time.
You know, you mentioned him as somebody that's made the decision. I mean, I certainly understand the transactional relationship, you know, the people who go, okay, I'm going to have to take these positions because I want certain things. Lindsey Graham seems to be in a different category. I mean, he went from being one of the strongest Trump critics, one of the a real maverick, a close friend of John McCain, to being not just an enabler, because there's a lot of senators who are just keeping their heads down and going along, but Lindsey Graham has become this sycophantic shill. Those are my words, not your words. And I mean, look, he's up for re-election. He doesn't want to lose the primary. He's not going to lose the primary, but he seems to be going way above and beyond what's necessary. Do you have any, what the hell's happened with Lindsey Graham?
You know, the old saying is, if you can't say anything nice, don't say anything at all. So I'm just going to stay quiet on that one. How about that?
Okay, I appreciate it. Well, yeah. Mark Sanford, former governor. Now, by the way, what is the protocol? Should people call you Governor Sanford, Congressman Sanford? What is the rule of thumb?
Hey you.
Hey you.
Hey you is fine. Yeah, whatever is fine. But I will say this, just as we wrap things up, I think we're walking our way toward the most significant financial crisis in the history of our country. And we are kidding ourselves to think that a financial tsunami, a tidal wave, is not coming based on the buildup of debt, based on our debt to GDP numbers, based on personal wealth numbers relative to GDP. There are just a lot of cracks out there in the armor that say, oh, my goodness, if we don't get serious as Republicans and conservatives about that being a core issue, which it's not right now, and that's one of my real beefs with the president, it just doesn't seem to matter, and it matters greatly, we're going to be in real trouble. And it's going to have a profound impact in the lifestyle of our kids, the value of our savings, the future worth of the dollar, and frankly, rates of inflation going forward. The other thing that I think we've got to be really re-engaged on is the degree to which we're engaged with the rest of the world. I mean, ultimately, you know, isolationism doesn't work. We have been the recipient of making a lot of things work because we've been connected to the rest of the world. Is there dislocation? Yes. Did people lose a lot of textile jobs in South Carolina? Absolutely. Was it a hard time? Yes. Are there still some families suffering? Yes. But, you know, as a consequence of that change, we've now have high-end manufacturing. We got BMW, we got Volvo, and a lot of other spots that have infilled. There is transition, and it can be tough on people. But I think we're making a real mistake if we continue down this tariff. I mean, a tariff is simply a tax. We're increasing more and more away of tax, and we're isolating ourselves economically in ways that I think will prove dangerous if we continue on the course that we're on. So I just leave you with those two thoughts.
Well,
things that we need to be thinking about and talking about.
And, you know, with all the reversals that we've seen among Republicans, among conservatives, I still find both of those things to be among the most stunning. You know, being from Wisconsin and talking with Paul Ryan for years and years and years about the entitlement crisis, the debt bomb, the consequences of running these deficits, and then suddenly seeing the Republican Party just flip a switch, including the Freedom Caucus, flip a switch, totally indifferent to this issue. America needs at least one fiscally conservative party, and it is terrifying. And I remember, I've seen all of charts, and I understand all of the consequences, or at least I thought I did. And then to watch the Republican Party abandon that and also abandon free trade has been, you know, on the list of sort of stunning reversals that we've seen. Mark Sanford, thank you so much.
Yes, Joe, I'm sorry. It's a real pleasure, and to be continued. You take good care, and thanks for letting me join you. You know, I appreciate what you're doing to preach the real gospel on that front, because, you know, the tariffs are, you know, for instance, with the refrigerators and washing machines and dryers, you know, it's $800,000 a job to protect the job. So, well, I don't know that that math works for the everyday consumer. So thanks for what you're doing to
keep
people pointing in the right direction. Yes, sir.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.